Pleasure to introduce Sigurd Ness, who's visiting us this week from the University of Oslo. Sigurd is a very, has been a very central figure in the ACT collaboration for many years at the upcoming SO collaboration, and is really an expert in all aspects of the experiment. And today he's going to give us sort of a broad talk about ACT. Sigurd is visiting all week, so if you'd like to meet with him, just send him an email. His email address was in the seminar announcement. Sigurd knows everything about everything, and I can't recommend him enough. We're going to have a speaker dinner this evening for Sigurd at 6 p.m. in the bistro. So if you're interested in coming, just send me an email so that I can make a little reservation for the speaker dinner. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. So I'll be giving you a preview of the upcoming ACT Data Release 6. I wish it was the full result I could show, but it's not all ready yet. So, but maybe first I'll say something about what ACT actually is, or was. So ACT stands for the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and it observed until 2022, so it doesn't exist anymore. But while it did exist, it was one of the two high-resolution CMB telescopes in the world. And by high-resolution, I mean that it has roughly five times the resolution of the Planck telescope, which is like the normal standard for CMB observations. And you can see here where it's located in the world. It's in the Atacama Desert in Chile, not that far away from the equator. And that's an advantage, because being near the equator means you have access to most of the sky. Our biggest competitors are the South Pole Telescope and BICEP, which are on the South Pole. And at the South Pole, they typically have three times less water vapor in the atmosphere than what we have. So overall, they have better observing conditions, but the cost of that is that they can only see a small part of the sky. Of course, I mentioned water vapor. So when you observe in the roughly 100 gigahertz range, then spectral lines from water vapor is the biggest single issue we observe with observing. And so you want to be above as much as the water vapor as possible. And that's why this telescope is at 5,200 meters altitude, and why it's in one of the driest places in the world also. So if you compare that to the type of water vapor levels we would see here, you would be measuring it in many centimeters instead of like a millimeter. So you can see the ACT site here. This is where ACT was. Our neighbors are the polar bear and Klaas, and CCAT Prime will be at the top of that mountain over there, a bit higher up. And we are building Simons Observatory, which is partially the inheritor of ACT over here. And the Simons Observatory Large Telescope, which was sort of like ACT 2, is already built, just waiting for its main mirrors. So this is what the telescope itself looks like. It's surrounded by a big ground screen that just serves to block out the horizon. And the telescope itself is here with a 6-meter main mirror. So this is what the ACT collaboration looks like. It's about 160 collaborators in 45 institutions, which I picture here from a meeting in Princeton recently. Okay, so ACT has observed since 2008, I think, but the current survey is the Advanced ACT survey, which started after a big upgrade of the instrument in 2016. And so it observed from 2017 to 2025 in the five frequency bands you can see over here. So basically roughly 30, 40, 90, 150, and 220 gigahertz. Though I must stress that each band is so broad that talking about a single number here is not very meaningful. You can see they almost overlap. So we didn't finish to analyze these two lowest bands in time for this data release. So they will be in a future data release. So what I'll be talking about now will be these upper three bands, which are also far more sensitive to the CMB than the lower bands here. So if you combine the sensitivity from all the bands, which basically means these two bands in practice, then we have a typical sensitivity of instantaneous sensitivity of 6.1 microkelvin root seconds. That might mean something to some of you, but it basically says how quickly you accumulate sensitivity in the sky. And when you project that on the sky, you'll find that we cover an area, which is shown up here, which is roughly 19,000 square degrees. And we are deeper than Planck over that area. So what's shown here is the act depth in contours with the numbers labeling the depth in microkelvin arc minutes. And the background here is showing the Planck dust map, just so you can see which part of the sky are more or less clean. So the typical depth here is around 10 microkelvin arc min, which is really quite good considering how big this area is. And if you compare this to our previous data releases, then you can see them over here. So the red curve is ACT data release 4, which is the previous cosmology quality data release we've had. So this is the last time ACT would have published things like its power spectrum and parameters.
When was that?
That is several years ago. That's like 4 years ago or something.
DR5 is but now?
No. DR5 is an interim data release we had, which was not for... not cosmology quality, okay? It was not sufficiently calibrated to do things like make a reliable CMB power spectrum, but it was good enough for things like making point source catalogs and cluster catalogs and stuff. So yeah, data release 5 is a big step from data release 4, but the point is it sort of doesn't count because we couldn't do all the science with this data release. So really what you should be comparing is data release 6 and data release 4. And you can see how big a step this is. For example, the dashed gray curve here is showing the mean Planck depth across the sky. So ACT data release 4 was only deeper than Planck over around 4,000 square degrees, but now we're deeper than Planck basically, you know, in our whole area, and quite a bit deeper. I've also shown the typical white noise range for Simons Observatory and CMB S4 in this gray band here. Of course, it's a bit misleading because, you know, it's really this thing to the minus second, which is the sensitivity. But okay, so to summarize, this upcoming data release will have between 6 times and 10 times as much statistical power as data release 4, depending on whether we manage to include the daytime observations or not, which are a bit more difficult to process. So this is...
What's going on with the area? Why is this cumulative area dependence?
Basically, this is just a distribution function, okay? So this is showing how... if you were to transpose this, it would be the distribution function for the depth. That's the easiest way to think about it. Another way to think about it is that you can say, okay, choose a noise level like 15 microkelvin arc minutes, and then move to the right. And you can see, okay, we have 17,000 square degrees that are at least as deep as that level. Yeah. So this is the biggest increase in sensitivity we've had in ACT, the biggest step from a previous data release. To next one. Here's an example of what the maps look like. So here at the top, we have the standard CMB total intensity map. You can see the typical red and blue blobs, which are warmer and colder regions. And you can see also point sources in red. The next one is more interesting. That's the CMB E-mode polarization map. So this is what happens when you take the Stokes Q and U parameter and transform them into E and B. So that's E and B. So you can see clearly that in E modes, the signal to noise is not as good as in T, but it's still high enough that you are dominated by signal on the modes you see here. And that's not at all the case for something like Planck. In Planck, this would just look like noise. So it's nice to be at the stage now when we look at the E-mode polarization map, it's sort of like what our T-mode polarization maps used to look like when we started observing. This is the B-mode map. This is where we would ideally see interesting new physics, but what you're seeing here is basically just our noise properties. We don't have a detection here, at least not by eye. We haven't actually unblinded our power spectrum, so you know, who knows what we'll see, but this is probably just noise. Except for these two, like these quadrupole-like things, that's what polarized point sources look like in E and B. And finally, at the bottom here, I've filtered the total intensity map so that we remove as much of the CMB as possible so we can see all the other stuff we can see. And you can see it looks sort of like a starry sky all these little dots, both positive and negative. The positive ones are mostly quasars, and the negative ones are galaxy clusters, which we see as decrements in the intensity due to the Sunyaev-Sildovich effect. So there's a lot of science we can do here that has nothing to do with traditional CMB science.
What is F?
F is the filtered total intensity map. It's this map, but with the large scales removed. Nothing more complicated than that.
Can you see the lensing in the B map?
Lensing, ideally you could see lensing in the B map, but seeing it by eye here is not very realistic. But we'll definitely see lensing in the B map when we do the power spectrum analysis. So this is where ideally I would show you our DAC Dataloo 6 CMB power spectrum, but sadly we have not unblinded that yet. So this is a forecast. But let me explain what this graph shows. So here we've got TT, EE, and BB power spectra. The gray data points is actual Planck data, with the columns showing the size of the error bar. The black curve is lambda CDM fit to Planck. The blue bars is what we last published in ACT Dataloo 4. So you can see they start over here and they go to much higher L than Planck. And the red boxes is my forecast for ACT Dataloo 6. So you can see the error bars are basically so small that it looks like a line. They're almost invisible out here. So you can see just how big an improvement ACT Dataloo 6 is over both Dataloo 4 and over Planck. Now I should say over here, this forecast is ignoring the signal to noise in component separation. You know, I'm assuming you can just combine the frequencies together and get the spectrum. So it's a bit optimistic over here, but most of this should be realistic. But I think this way of showing it is not really that useful, because what we really care about in this forecast is the size of the error bars, and they're basically invisible. So there's a different way of plotting this I prefer. And this is when you take each data point and divide it by its error bar to get the effectively signal to noise per multipole, or signal to noise per L, including cosmic variance. And that's what I'm plotting here. So this is basically showing the value at each multipole divided by the error bar at that multipole. So the red curve here is Planck. You can see Planck gets killed here at high L due to its beam and the CMB falling off. The blue and pink curves are ACT DR4 and SPT 2018, which is the most recent SPT published result. And I'm including that because SPT is the telescope that's the most comparable to ACT. And then the yellow curves is what you get for ACT Dataloo 6, according to my forecast. If you include daytime data or if you only use nighttime observations. So whether you don't get the daytime or not, you still have a huge improvement. So here you can see that we expect to be better than Planck above LO1500 in TT.
Is SPT going to have a similar improvement?
So SPT is taking a long time to publish. Their SPT 3G instrument, which is the one that's currently observing, has pretty much the same instantaneous sensitivity as ACT. So they should be accumulating data at the same rate as we're doing, but they're doing it in a much smaller area. So they should have a small patch, which is much deeper than us. And so that means they will be better at measuring faint signals, but worse at measuring stronger signals. In practice, this means that they will be better at measuring BB than us, but they will be worse at T and E. But they should be having a big step up also. It's just not clear how big. Okay, but that's TT. That TT is not where our biggest improvement is. And that the best one is EE. So here you can see the same thing just for EE, and you can see just how big this is compared to Planck, for example. The reason why the DR6 curves cut off at 500 is because we are probably not going to be using the data below there due to null tests. So basically there's some systematics there which we don't have time to fully resolve. But That's also the point where our curve would probably be getting down to the Planck level anyway, so it's not too big of a loss. So yeah, here's a forecast for some standard cosmological parameters. So you can see that for H0, NS, and NF, our improvement is considerable respect to data release 4, but compared to Planck, it's only a minor improvement. Now we get 2 times an improvement in sensitivity to new light relic particles in the form of NF compared to Planck. And that's a picture that sort of holds in general, that the standard cosmological parameters is something where we see only a modest improvement of a Planck, but extensions to lambda CDM, we often see quite big improvements. So here's another example from, which is a forecast from Colin Hill, for an example extension of the standard model, which includes early dark energy. Here you can see just how big the improvement is, right? You go from active release 4 alone, which is this huge contour here, and Planck alone, this huge green blob there, to quite compact error bars. So this is an example where we get... how big is the improvement again? Oh, I haven't written down how big it is. But anyway, it's an example where this is it's a much bigger improvement. Okay, so that's all the stuff where I only had forecasts, but we have some data we actually are ready to show, and that's the lensing. So just for those of you who haven't thought about this before, but on its way from the surface of last scattering to us, CMB photons are deflected by the large-scale structure of the universe. So here's an example of what that would look like if you had a really overmassive spot in the CMB, much bigger than is realistic. So basically what happens if you have an overdensity is that the light rays get deflected around it, and so it looks like that spot has been magnified. Similarly, if you have an underdensity, it will appear to be demagnified. And so that suggests a way you could try to measure the mass distribution in the universe simply by looking at which parts of the skies appear to be magnified and demagnified. And you can see that conceptually by making a little power spectrum in this region and a little power spectrum in this region and comparing the two. And you'll see that the part where you have been magnified will appear to be peak at lower L than the parts that have not been magnified. Of course, the actual algorithm you use to reconstruct the mass distribution is a bit more fancy than this, but this is the basic principle. So what does measuring that actually tell us? Well, the deflection is caused by the mass inhomogeneities in the universe. So you're basically measuring the clumpiness of the universe. And you can see at different length scales, we are sensitive to different redshifts. So here you have the length scale effectively, the multiple on the x-axis. And each of these colored bands corresponds to the contribution from a different redshift range. So you can see at low L, so in large scales in the sky, we are dominated by the nearby universe, which makes sense from geometric arguments. While at high L, we see lots of stuff at much higher redshift. But the typical redshift, like the most representative redshift, is around 2. And that is useful, because it's a different redshift range than what other probes of large-scale structure typically probe. So we got, for example, surveys that measure the distribution of galaxies in the universe, and they tend to probe lower redshifts than this. Redshifts that are where they also are more nonlinear. And this is useful because those surveys tend to see a disagreement with lambda CDM to a minor level. There's this tension, which is not as famous as the H0 tension, but called the S8 tension, where you can see here that so S8, which parameterizes the clumpiness of the universe, inferred from the Planck CMB power spectrum and the W plus the ACT CMB power spectrum in green points, and then various probes of large-scale structure, like by galaxy counts mostly, over here. As you can see, the individual points are not really discrepant with what Planck sees, but there's this trend that they all tend to be low, well, almost all. So the question is this something real? Is there actually a tension between like the later universe structure and the early universe structure? And that's one thing we can try to test here by measuring something which is at intermediate redshift. So that's what I've tried to show here, that the green data points are basically taking data from over here. And then most of these blue points over here come from this redshift range. And what we measure is basically this redshift range. So that's one thing we can try to test. Do we see the same discrepancy here that galaxy surveys see? So yeah. So we use this basic approach over here to measure the projected mass distribution in the sky, and this is what we get. This is not a forecast. This is the actual ACT Data Release 6 lensing map. And so you can see all these dark and bright spots. This has all been filtered in a way so that all of these spots are real. Okay, this is all signal-dominated spots. And you can see how big an area where we have this signal-dominated set. And just to illustrate that we really are seeing real things, we have this cutout here that I'll show on the next slide. And here I'm comparing it to the CIB. So basically Planck can measure the cosmic infrared background, which also peaks roughly at the redshift of 2. And so the background field here in gray, in dark and white, shows where we think there are under and over densities in mass based on our lensing map. And then the colored contours show the cosmic infrared background. And hopefully by eye you can see that there is a good correspondence between these two, even though, so there are different probes of the large scale structure, and they are measured in completely different ways. The CIB is measured directly from the light we receive, while the other one is, while the lensing is measured through the deflection of light. And nevertheless, you can see that we have, you know, where there's a white blob, there tends to be red circles, and where there's a dark blob, there tends to be dark circles. So, of course, that's expected, but it's really nice to see, I think. Okay, of course, to do actual physics, one looks at the lensing power spectrum. So this is a sort of summary plot for what this has looked, how this has changed through the years. It's a bit faint on the screen, maybe. But you can see how, like in the first measurements of the lensing spectrum from ACT 2011, you had basically, you know, here's one measurement and here's another measurement, you know. Like 4 horrible data points, but it was enough to get a detection. And then you can see how things have improved. So Planck 2022 is the main thing to compare to. That's actually a big improvement over previous Planck lensing spectra. So it's the end pipe analysis, which is about 50% better than the 2018 Planck results. So it would have been more flattering to us if Planck hadn't done that reanalysis of of their data. But you can see that we have basically exactly the same error bars as what Planck has in the lensing spectrum, even though we measure about 1/3 of the sky to much greater depth than they do, while they measure a broad area. So we basically have independent measurements from Planck here. Yeah, this is just the same thing, showing how much ACT has improved over the years. Okay. So this is showing more directly what I said about how both Planck had improved. So the dotted line is what Planck 2018 had for the lensing spectrum, and you can see they were just barely signal dominated. By the way, so the black curve is the signal power spectrum, and the dotted lines are the noise power spectrum. So where the noise power spectrum is higher than the signal power spectrum, you can't really trust anything you see by eye in the map. The signal is weaker than the noise. But you can see, so ACT 2018 were just barely signal dominated at L of like a few tens. But the reanalysis in 2022 is a lot better. But even still, ACT Data Release 6 is better than that again. So here you can see the broad range of multiples over which we are signal dominated. So if you take into account the difference in sky area, then we have a 43 sigma detection of CMB lensing for ACT and 42 sigma for Planck. So it's basically the same level.
Sorry, I don't understand. Your noise is much better than AXO, but why is this 43 versus?
Yeah. So this is talking about per mode. So for each mode on the sky, we have about twice as high signal to noise than as what Planck has. But Planck has more modes because they have a bigger sky area. And that compensates, just happens to compensate. So we end up with basically exactly the same signal to noise, but it's still valuable because we have a really relatively low overlap in what information we measure. So you can combine them later to get an even better measurement. Okay, but anyway, to get back to this S8 tension, what can we say about that? So here you can see that ACT lensing by itself measures sigma 8 equals 0.819. And if you compare that directly to, you can also combine it with Planck, and then you get 0.815, and you can see the error bar went down a bit. And if you compare that to the Planck CMB anisotropies, which are measured at much higher redshift than the lensing, you can see the number is completely consistent, so 0.811. So basically, our lensing measurement is completely consistent with the Planck CMB anisotropies. And you can see that over here. So this is a similar plot to what I showed. Actually, it's better to look at this one. So basically, there's this thing called sigma 8, and there's this thing called S8. And they're basically the same quantity. It's just a different linear combination with the omega m that reduces the error bars. So we can look at this one. And here you can see that, again, we have the blue data points that are shifted low here, and the green data points that are high. And you can see the red data points, which are the CMB lensing points, are completely in line with the CMB anisotropies. So as far as we are concerned, there is no S8 tension. Before I move on to the next topic, I should say that that doesn't mean that the galaxy surveys are wrong. It's just, because they measure, first of all, it's a different redshift, so you could say maybe something is happening at even lower redshift than 2. But maybe more importantly, they are measuring different length scales. So it could be that something is happening on length scales that are too small for us to measure with CMB lensing, but which these galaxy surveys measure. So we can't exclude it. But at least from our point of view, there's nothing mysterious going on.
Do you know what length scales you are measuring?
Yeah, if you look back at this here. Oh, I guess you wanted physical. I don't have the physical number at the top of my head, sorry. But length scale-wise, we are measuring things which are of the order of like L of 1,000 or something, 100 to 1,000. So that would mean that it's things that are between roughly a degree and maybe a fifth of a degree.
What is that, like redshift 2-ish?
Yeah, redshift 2.
So, the Coulombing distance, I guess, is 1.
Aha, don't ask.
Is that right? We can write redshift 1 is like 3 gigaparsecs, and so redshift 2 maybe is like 5 or something, maybe. And so then if I do 1,000 divided by 5,000, then it's for like 0.2-ish megaparsecs.
Sounds sensible, yeah.
Okay, which is similar to sigma 8 scales, I guess, right? Okay, right.
Yeah, I guess the point is, it's not exactly clear they are different. I mean, obviously they are different redshifts, but the scales them seem that different.
Yeah, so I don't work directly on the lensing myself, but the lensing people in ACT have calculated to what extent, for example, we are affected by linear scales. And we are very, very mildly affected by linear scales, by non-linear scales, yeah. Which is not the case for the galaxy surveys. So
you are more linear than they are.
We are much more linear than they are. We are only marginally affected by non-linear effects, but that is, I should have said that, but you can see there is a gray area over here. This is what we do not include in our likelihood because we are not confident in our modeling of nonlinearities and foregrounds. So that's even though we have good data points all the way out here, we don't use them.
Oh, the top hat is actually shows the number I was trying to calculate. Okay.
I forgot about that. Yeah. Well, there you have it.
wasn't bad.
Okay, another thing we can measure using lensing is the neutrino mass. So here you got a bunch of different measurements plotted. So the two main ones to compare to is the yellow line, which is the Planck results, so Planck lensing plus Planck CMB anisotropies. And that one gives some of the neutrino mass to be less than 0.14 electron volts at the 95% confidence interval. If you instead combine Planck CMB anisotropies with ACT lensing, then you get a somewhat better number, 0.12 electron volt. And if you combine all three, so Planck lensing, ACT lensing, and Planck CMB, you still actually get only 0.12. And as far as I understand, this improvement is less than you would expect due to unfortunate noise fluctuations, basically, that the Planck by itself bound is actually a bit better than it should be due to them having a lucky negative noise fluctuation.
Do you know offhand, I'm curious how much the adding lensing at all improves this, like, do you know offhand what the number is for just primary?
With no lensing? By the way, BAOs are also included here. Yeah, I think lensing helps quite a bit, but I didn't write that number on this slide. But I think lensing is really one of the best observables for measuring this. I don't think there's any number that's better than what we have here for the neutrino mass. There's a small asterisk to this. There has actually been some published numbers that you might have seen that seemed just as good, like Planck data release 3 had a stronger neutrino bound of 0.12 than Planck data release 4, actually, even though Planck data release 4 N-pipe had a much better lensing spectrum, as you could see. They still ended up with a worse bound on the neutrino mass. And as I said, this is thought to be due to it being a negative noise fluctuation, basically. So, you know, when you have an upper bound, the bound has a randomness to it, and sometimes it just fluctuates low. So in this case, when you added more data to Planck, the bound got worse.
Noise fluctuations in with what noise? Like the the atmospheric noise?
Well, for Planck, it's mostly white noise, right? Yeah.
Oh, yes, Planck.
Yeah, right? If you just look up what Planck published in 2018 and what they published in N-pipe, you'll see that their published neutrino bounds got worse.
Like the peak of the probability density is non-zero for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to read entirely too much into a very marginal one.
Yeah. I should say none of these include the ACT CMB anisotropies because they're not unblinded yet, but that would improve things further. Okay, one can also do lensing tomography. So the lensing spectrum by itself doesn't say anything about where things are happening. It's just an integral over the line of sight. But if you cross-match with surveys that do have discrete redshift information, then you can actually try to get a per redshift lensing spectrum. So we've done some of that also. Though these, we have several papers in progress that are doing this, but they're not ready yet, sadly. So what I'm showing here is an example plot from data list 4, so the real plots will look a lot better than this. But here you can see an example of how we can see how the lensing spectrum changes from redshift bin to redshift bin. And of course, that will help you probe how structure is growing over time. Okay, so now I'm moving on to a slightly different topic, which is the Sunyal-Sidovich effect. So, if you're not familiar with that, it's basically that when CMB photons are moving through hot intracluster medium, then it encounters electrons with high energy, which kick them up into a higher frequency than they used to have. So you can see here is the original blackbody spectrum in the dashed curve, and it gets deformed so that you have fewer photons at low frequency and more photons at a higher frequency. And this means that you get an observable where at very low frequency, there's not much of a change. But then you get a range where you have less intensity coming from the direction of the cluster. And then it switches at around 217 gigahertz to having more intensity coming from that cluster. Now, if you remember the earliest slide I showed, then our frequency range is basically covering this area here. So we expect to see clusters as decrements in temperature. So given that you know that it should have this spectral shape, you can try to remove all the other signals and only keep that one. And that's something we do through the internal linear combination method. And here's what you end up if you do that. So this is our combined ACT-86 and Planck Compton Y parameter map. The Y parameter basically just quantifies how much this spectrum has been distorted by. And you can see that we see lots of little dots, which are almost too small to see here. Those are individual clusters. And you can see a few more extended things, like this is the nearby Virgo cluster. So here's a zoom of what that looks like.
Sorry, can you go back? The big white things on the left, what are they?
Those are holes. Okay, so these are spots in the map where there were two strong foregrounds, and so we had to mask them. So there's nothing exciting about those holes. Yeah, you can also see that we've cut the galaxy. Our actual sky area would continue out here and continue at the edge here. But again, the galaxy was too strong, and so we couldn't get a good Y map there. So here's an example of what this map looks like when you zoom into it, this time in grayscale. So there's quite a lot of noise here, and you can also see the faint residual imprint of the CMB here, because an ILC map is not guaranteed to eliminate all the other components. It eliminates the combination of noise and components. So it forms the linear combination that minimizes the sum of those two things. But you can see these little dots here, 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 dot, 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 dot. Those are individual clusters. And at the bottom, it's the same thing if you don't include ACT, okay? If you'd only use Planck. So this is what you win by including ACT here. So basically, in Planck, you can only see basically this cluster. And this thing over here is, I think, that might be a, no, it's probably a cluster too, yeah. Anyway, yeah, this is just showing again what it actually looks like in the raw map. So here's the Compton Y map again for a relatively bright cluster, and here's what it looks like in our actual CMB map. So this is a three-component map where the red, green, and blue color channels are mapped to 90 gigahertz, 150 gigahertz, and 220 gigahertz respectively. So the CMB is the foggy gray thing in the background here, and it looks gray because in the units we are using, the CMB is equally bright at all frequencies. These little reddish dots, those are quasars. They are red because they have a synchrotron spectrum, which is falling in frequency. And you can see this cluster looks dark blue. It looks dark in red and green because there's a decrement in intensity there. And it is still blue because there's no decrement in 220 gigahertz. And just to see that, show that it's something real we're seeing here, here is what you get when you zoom in on the same spot using DES. So you can see that, yes, there really is a cluster at that location. No, no, this is, that one is like this, yeah. Yeah. So when you do this over the full area and count things, then with the DR5 data release, which, as I showed earlier, is sort of intermediate between DR4 and DR6, we found more than 4,000 clusters that could be optically confirmed at a signal-to-noise of more than 4. And that's what's shown here. So each little cross is one cluster. Our preliminary numbers for DR6 was, at the time when I made this presentation, 6,800 clusters. But actually, we already have improved the data slightly, and now it's more than 8,000 clusters. So just for comparison, what does that number mean? Well, the best catalog outside from ACT is the Planck cluster catalog, and it has 1,200 confirmed clusters. So this is a huge step up when it comes to trying to do cluster statistics.
Just out of curiosity, doesn't the SC effect mess up your detector calibration? Because I thought that the frequencies of the CMB detectors were calibrated to the black body of the CMB, right?
But
that's shifting the black body, doesn't that mess up the calibration of the detector?
But look at what it looks like.
Yeah, it's like...
It's a few tiny spots, right? On most of the sky, you're completely dominated by other things. So that's the first thing. The TSC is subdominant to most of the components of the sky. Most places in the sky, not in the middle of the clusters, but most places it's subdominant. But even more importantly, ACT does not use the CMB as its main calibration source. The main calibration is done using Saturn. Right, we observe Saturn with a telescope, and then we see how bright it is compared to the known brightness. And we also, for relative calibration between detectors, we also use actually the atmosphere itself. Like all the detectors should be seeing roughly the same atmosphere. So if one of them is seeing 10 times lower signal, it's probably something wrong with the calibration. We do have a final step in the end where we cross-match our total intensity map versus Planck to just get one overall normalization of the whole map. But again, that's not really affected by TSC, both because TSC is subdominant and because there should be the same amount of TSC in ACT and Planck.
One question, when you say confirmed clusters, that means optically confirmed?
Yes, it means optically confirmed. And so, in theory, something could go wrong with optical confirmation too. Like if your optical catalog is too dense, then you could have a chance alignment. But I think this is still pretty reliable.
That adds sensitivity. You might hope to see high redshift clusters that don't show up in the optical observer.
Yeah, exactly. So we do have clusters that can't be confirmed, not because they're not real, but because there's nothing to confirm them. That's harder to deal with. So but we'll publish that. It's just not the same, catalog. So here's an example of what this looks like. So here's the mass inferred for the cluster. And here's the redshift. These are different surveys. So you can see the DES 3-year optical cluster catalog is over here, and it hits a pretty steep wall. I'm not sure exactly why it's so steep, but I think at least they have something like a redshift to the fourth power falloff or something in their sensitivity. And then you've got the Planck cluster catalog, which is over here. And then the SPT and ACT catalogs. But this is again the Dataliz 5 catalog in green. So sadly, the data points are so big here that it's a bit hard to see how many data points there are. But you can see that we have some data points that go all the way up to about redshift of 2 for clusters. But as you said, some of the higher redshift clusters are being cut simply due to the lack of an optical thing to compare them to.
So that seems kind of weird. I mean, why do you want confirmation from something that's optimal, worse than your survey?
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I think.
So are there objects, for low redshift that are not confirmed by optical?
I think as you go to, so we use because we're going to be cross-matching against other things, we use a quite low signal-to-noise threshold of 4. And when you have a big area and you use 4 sigma cutoff, that you will have lots of interlopers. So the stuff at the bottom here, it would really continue a bit further with the things that are not real. So if you didn't want to cross correlate against something, you would use a cutoff more like 5 or 5.5. I can say in general, the advantage of finding clusters using the Sinyal-Seldovich effect rather than optical surveys is that we have a roughly redshift independent selection function, which is very different from what you can see here, where there's a sudden cutoff. And that means basically we get a mass selection rather than a redshift selection. And this makes it much more clean to measure how common is a cluster of a given mass as a function of redshift. But we always need to cross-correlate against something in order to do science, because we need to know the redshift of the clusters. If you don't know the redshift of the cluster, it's hard to do much. So
you could do cross-correlation, that's right, but you don't have to confirm it.
Yeah, and maybe they do so. This is not the part I work on either. I mainly work on producing the maps and detecting objects in the maps. So sorry, I can't answer that so well. Actually, I think ACT was originally designed in order to measure exactly this Sinyal-Sidovich effect and detect clusters that way, because it was seen as a very promising way of doing cosmology, to see the growth of structure. But then it turned out to be a big disappointment, because you need to be able to translate between the y amount of the size of the TEC effect and the mass of the cluster. And this turned out to have three parameters that, when you marginalized over them, basically meant you had no sensitivity left. But now that's starting to be solved, and one of the ways you can solve that is by calibrating using cluster lensing. So, you know, we have a CMB lensing map, and CMB lensing doesn't just happen with the large diffuse structures in the universe, they also happen around every single cluster. It's just too weak to detect individually for each cluster in our map. But when you stack lots of them, then you get what you see here. So here we've stacked about 4,000 clusters. So you make a lensing map, you stack that lensing map on the location of the clusters, and you get a map like this, which is a 15 sigma detection of cluster lensing. And what you can do then is that you can, now you have a measurement of the total mass of that, that population of clusters, and you can compare it to the total y from that cluster, and that gives you a mass calibration.
So are you doing this just for the confirmed clusters or for all the clusters?
I'm pretty sure this is done for the confirmed clusters. Yeah. Are you worried?
I mean, that could bias things, because, I mean, the confirmed ones are the ones that just happen to you. There would be more stuff in front, probably, because of, you would see it optically as well. So I'm just wondering, that could be a systematic effect. I'm not sure how it's going to change your 1 minus b, but
yeah, I'm afraid I'm not the right person to answer that. But I think, so if you're curious about this, then you've got the lensing group in ACT. So
since the paper isn't out yet, there's a chance to.
Yeah.
There is another outcome.
How's that 15 sigma? It looks like a million sigma to me.
Oh, does it? 15 sigma is actually very high. The point where your eye will start to think, yeah. There's something there. Yeah, that's around 4 or 5 sigma.
I see.
So you can see the background fluctuations there, right? It's not so out of this world that this should be 15 times higher than those fluctuations, is it? I think it seems pretty reasonable. I think if it were, like, what would you say to us? Like 50? If it were 50, you wouldn't be able to see the background. So I think 15 seems right here. Okay, and over here, it's just a comparison of different calibrations of the bias. And you can see lensing it, measuring it in this way is, it's not quite the strongest measurements, but it's independent of the others. And it's still, you know, only worse by about 30% compared to the best one.
And so these stack clusters have the similar properties, or like are there parameters that by doing this you are marginalizing more?
I don't remember, sorry. Okay, moving on to a different topic. So I've given examples of how in the CMB maps we measure, there's a lot more than just the CMB. So much of that is stuff that that has still been popular to do science with in CMB, like Sinyal-Sidovich or lensing. But here are some more exotic things that people usually don't associate with CMB maps at all. So, for example, we can see the radio lobes of an active galactic nucleus here in Fornax A. So there's a so this is what you can see in radio plus optical. There's elliptical galaxies here and these huge lobes. And we see those lobes directly, and they're very strongly polarized. We can see planetary nebula, like the Helix Nebula. Of course, not as nice as Hubble, but... we can map out the galactic dust pretty well, especially since we have 5 times the resolution of Planck. We also see several nearby galaxies that we can actually resolve. For example, we can see that this is an edge on spiral, and there's a face on spiral, and so on, in the Leo triplet. We can see clusters, as I said, and some of them are merging. So we can see the shape, like it's elongated because it's merging. We even see of the order of like 50 stars, which is, that maybe doesn't sound so fancy. You know, you can see lots of stars in the optical, but seeing them in a CMB map is not normal. So for example, we see Mira, Betelgeuse, and Pi 1. Don't remember which one that is, but yeah. We also see some supernova remnants. So here's a VLA plus Spitzer map of a supernova remnant, W44, and here's what it looks like for us.
These are so these stars that you're showing, sort of these like dust?
Yeah, you can be a bit nitpicky and say, are we really seeing the star? And we are not seeing the optical photosphere. The optical photosphere is too small for us to see it. What we're seeing is an extended cloud of dust around the star, which is still hot due to the radiation from the star.
Can you see solar flares?
Yes, we can, yeah. I'll come to that soon, okay. I'll do it right now. So I did this thing where I tried to look for the hypothetical Planet 9 using our data set. You might think that's completely crazy, but I'll show you it's not crazy to look for it with our data set. I didn't find it, but what I did find accidentally were some transients, basically spots in the sky where there's nothing, and then suddenly, bloop, there's something. Here's an example of one of these. So you can see this time it's minutes on the x-axis. So this is very fast. And you can see here's an object which goes from basically nothing, and then 10 minutes later, it's 1.2 Jenskis, which is quite bright, and then it starts falling again. So this turned out to be a flare from the star with a long name, which is 62 parsecs away.
This is like a few pixels?
This would look like a beam, right? All the points are just looked like the shape of our beam, which should typically be like 3 pixels. And if you translate this, I tried to, for fun, translate this into what it would look like in the terminology we use for solar flares. And I got it to be an X5 million flare, which would not be healthy if it happened for the sun. So I think for now we found 11 transients this way.
There are actually stars that suddenly become 5 million times brighter.
No, that's not what it means. There is this solar flares have this terminology like A flares and X flares and so on. The brightest flares are categorized as X. And then the number behind is like how many times over the threshold for being an X flare is it? So basically X is when it's a really extreme solar flare, and then this is X times 5 million is basically, okay? You might remember the Carrington event, which is like this. Yeah, so this is like much worse than that. But thankfully, it's not the sun that did it, it's the faraway star.
Do you know which kind of stars produced this?
Yeah, so this was a star which was not that big. I think it was Red Dwarf. And I think it was a relatively young star. In the first paper, we found three flaring stars, and at least two of them were young stars. And I think they flare quite heavily when they're young. So I don't think this is too unexpected, but these three events we found in that paper were the brightest events ever found in this frequency range. So, back to what I was actually going to say. So this is what our point source catalog looked like. So this is a mix of different things. The red points are mostly quasars and active galactic nuclei. We have around 27,000 of those. Then we have so-called flat spectrum ones, but that classifier is not really reliable. So really, they should also be seen as synchrotron sources. So totally, we have about 30,000 synchrotron sources. And then we have dusty objects, which tend to be galaxies not that far away. And those we have around 2,000 of. And then in this case, there's around 5,000 clusters, which are the yellow points. So for comparison again, we have about 30,000 point sources, and Planck has around 2,000. So again, it's a big step up. And what you can do with these points, for example, is to do forced photometry at their location as a function of time. And that gives you their light curves. And here's an example of some light curves. So here you can see we're following the brightness of this quasar from 2017 until 2021. And we have another year that's not shown here. So you can see that this is changing on month-to-month timescales, and this is completely typical. This is something I wasn't aware of when I started doing CMB mapmaking, that you can't just assume the sky is constant. All of these points, basically all the point sources are strongly variable.
Can you do some AGN variability constraints?
Yeah, we have an older paper about this, but we're making a new, much better one with these greatly improved measurements. The biggest problems we have is that our calibration is not that reliable. It's reliable to 5%, which means you get this unavoidable 5% sort of jitter. And also you can see we have these holes. So our cadence is spotty and irregular. So this is stuff we want to improve in Simon's Observatory, but we have to live with it for ACT.
That's your data? Both of them are your data?
Both of them are our data. It's I did this, and in parallel, a different team did this, but it's basically the same stuff.
It's just... Where are those holes?
Sorry?
Why do you have those holes?
So during the spring, the telescope is sometimes being maintained, and when it's not being maintained, there's this really bad weather period called the Bolivarian winter, Bolivian winter, yeah. So you can see it sort of happens every year. And then other things are just the telescope breaks, and then...
Are there optical counterparts or X-ray counterparts of these variable variabilities that you observe?
Yes, yes. We are not finding any quasars that other people haven't found before. In radio and optical, you can find more. But what we are providing is basically we're filling a hole in the frequency coverage. This whole microwave variable sky is really unexplored. So that's what we're providing here. It's not that these light... If I were to plot the optical light curve for this or the radio light curve, they would look a lot better. And part of the reason is that the pesky CMB is in the way. You know, the CMB is providing this background that...
But for these particular objects that you are plotting here, the variability, the optical in the X-ray, they show the same variability?
Exactly the same level. They are clearly variable in the optical and the radio, but not at the same level. So typically, if you plot them against each other, you'll see that one curve is fluctuating more than the other one. But I don't remember which one is fluctuating more. So that's the blind transient search. We can also even do solar system science. So we can see a few asteroids. Of course, we see them much more poorly than optical surveys see them. But by using a longer wavelength, we see slightly into the surface of the asteroid. We see basically not their actual surface, but we see a few millimeters into the surface. And this can actually be relevant because the asteroids are covered by a layer of dust, and so the properties could change. So basically what you can do is to see whether the flux you see at our frequency is consistent with the flux you see at other frequencies, and it's not. And we're actually not the only ones that see that. In general, there is a deficit of flux from asteroids in the microwave band compared to what you see.
So what is the property of that? Can you see into the moon?
The moon is too bright for us, sadly. Yeah, but it's like having X-ray vision very slightly. You're seeing a, yeah. I'm going over my time here. I'll finish soon. But here's what you can see. Like, so these are measurements from WISE, I think. This is the standard asteroid model, NEATM, that's fit to that. And you can see here's our data points. So they're lower. Of course, could still be that we have some systematic issue, but it really does seem quite a bit too big to be systematic. And we're not the only ones who have seen a deficit in these frequencies.
But is the prediction just like a thermal emission from the asteroid? Is that what that means?
Yeah, it's thermal and reflected light. Over here, it's all thermal.
Were you able to capture Oumuamua?
No. We are, first of all, that wasn't here very long. And secondly, we are really not that sensitive. You know, the problem is our beam is too big. We have an arc minute size beam. And the asteroid is tiny. So, yeah. I thought I had the Planet 9 one too, but I guess, here it is. I mentioned Planet 9 before. So just like we can see thermal emission from asteroids, we can also see thermal emission from planets. And when you're in the inner solar system, seeing the thermal emission as opposed to the reflected sunlight is a disadvantage because the reflected sunlight is usually much brighter than the thermal emission. But when you go far enough out, and you're looking at objects that are big enough that their heat is dominated by their heat of formation rather than the sun, then you'll find that reflected sunlight light goes as 1/4 to the fourth power, while thermal emission goes as 1/2 to the second power. So eventually thermal emission wins out. And so that's why at sufficiently large distances, we can actually be competitive to optical surveys. For Planet 9, it's predicted to be at roughly 500 AU, which is really far away. And so here I've compared the sensitivities of ACT, SO, so ACT is the red bars, SO plus ACT is the pink bars, and then things like WISE and LSST and PanSTARRS over here. So LSST just beats everything, it's just too good. But aside from that, you can see that the different curves are different variants of Planet 9. So you can see the fainter ones would not be seen by PanSTARRS. And you can also see that roughly the PanSTARRS and the SO bounds are pretty comparable. So this is a forecast. But to actually do it, you need to do this blind stacking analysis because you don't know what orbit they are. So you take all the different maps and you stack, you assume an orbit, you stack, and then you assume a new orbit and you stack, and so on. And I did this using our DR5 dataset. And this is the bounds you get. So the contours here show the distance to which I can exclude the presence of Planet 9. And you can see typically it's 300 to 500 AU, which I think is pretty interesting for a telescope that was never meant to do this, and that I think most people would never think could do anything like this. So that was fun. And we can also look at the galactic center. And you probably left with the question, when is it coming out? So we hoped it would be out by now. In fact, the goal was to have it out this summer. But then there were systematics and null tests and stuff. But we have unblinded the lensing. And we hope to unblind the power spectrum in a few weeks. So I think this end of winter is now obsolete. I think this spring, I think, is what we will probably be aiming for. You can look forward to that. And the next step, finally, is Simons Observatory. So ACT had one telescope with around 5,000 detectors. Simons Observatory will have a large telescope that starts out with 30,000 detectors, and then after an upgrade later, it will have 60,000 detectors. So it's a huge step up. It's in fact going quite a lot of the way towards CMBS-4. It will also have small telescopes with the same number of detectors that are meant to measure B modes. So we had actually first light earlier than this slide said. We had the first light in Simons Observatory about a month ago, but only for the small telescope, one of the small telescopes. But that's been pretty exciting. But we think that we will have be starting proper observations somewhere next summer. So, yeah. Okay, sorry for going over time. Any questions? Nope.
Is the spectrum for these flares very different than the spectrum for dust?
I have the spectrum for the flares in the paper. It's when I measured it in characteristic luminosity, which is like frequency times the luminosity, then it's relatively flat. Yeah, which means the spectrum is rising, but rising at roughly a power of like, it doesn't mean that, yeah. I can try to check it afterwards. Yeah, but I think the spectrum is not that strongly tilted.
Okay. So if you stacked, you know, CMB on you know some known stars, you know, then you couldn't maybe like distinguish flaring activity from from dust.
Ah. Well, the easiest way to distinguish them is to look at the time variability, right? The dust itself doesn't really change.
If you detect, the flaring individually, right? You know, for most stars, I mean, like the sun, I mean, I imagine you wouldn't detect flaring.
Ah, I see. So you're thinking we would be able to detect sort of the average flaring.
Is there flare? Does normal stars flare?
The sun is solar.
Normal stars do flare, but I think flares are sort of rare and intermittent. And so I think the integrated... No, I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. Basically, most stars are not surrounded by a huge cloud of dust. So most stars you wouldn't hope to detect at all. But when a star flares, that's not thermal emission. So that you have a hope of detecting. For example, I think I had a discussion a few days ago about the brightness of the sun in radio and how the sun could be a lot brighter in radio when it was flaring compared to normal. So I think if we see a star, then either it's because it's surrounded by a huge cloud of dust or it's because it's flaring. And if it's flaring, you should clearly see that it's not there in most of the time, but it's only there in a few sporadic episodes. So I don't think these are too hard to distinguish. For example, if you look at that spot where we saw that bright flare, usually we see nothing there. It's like a few minutes of our whole five-year thing where we see something. If a few of you want to stay for looking at our actual maps, then I can show you those also. Because I made this interactive map viewer. So I can start by showing, for example, if I zoom out a bit, you can see our survey area. So I should make sure clear that this is ACT plus Planck. So the large scales come from Planck and the small scales come from ACT here. So for example, if we go here. Yeah, it's a bit hard to see on this screen. No, this is the deepest part of the sky. I can switch to combined frequencies and then go to polarization. So here you can see the typical plus-like pattern of Q polarization and X-like pattern of U polarization and E and B. Yeah, things look very strange on that screen. But and if I zoom out, you can see that we can see that pattern everywhere, right? So this shows that we have high signal-to-noise E modes over our whole, 19,000 square degree area. Another fun thing to look at is, for example, if we look at the galactic dust, for example, this is the Orion Nebula when it loads. And if we do this, so then, I think I have Planck only here for compression. Yeah, so that's Planck only, and this is Planck plus ACT. So you can see that we're adding a lot of information on the smaller scales. And that's also something we write paper about. Like there was a paper recently where people made a line through here and looked at the spectrum as a function of position along that line. Another thing is just the amount of small scale objects. So if we do this and this and this, then so this is a grid where each little cell is a quarter of a square degree, and you can see we have many objects per one of those cells. So black dots like this one are clusters, and white dots are galaxies. So if you zoom into one of those clusters, then we can do this. So this is what it looks like in WISE, and this is what it looks like in DES. So you can see, yes, there is a cluster there, not a very big cluster, but yes. I also mentioned earlier that we had some galaxies we could see. This will be made public, by the way, when we publish ActDataLayer 6. So, example, here is edge on galaxy, and if we switch to WISE, then you can see, oh yeah, for some reason there's a hole here.
That's probably my fault.
Black square.
Is it some US base or something?
Oh yeah, one thing I wanted to, because you asked about stars, I want to show you just what that those dust clouds can look like. So there is a really bright star, which you can see here.
Mira caused a bunch of pain for us.
Ah, but this star is much worse than Mira.
Yeah.
This object is our brightest dusty object by far, by like a factor of 100 or something. This is CW Leonis. Let's just see what it looks like when we switch to WISE first. Well, in WISE it's so bright that it completely saturates not only the beam, but the side lobes are also saturated. And if we go to DES...
It's very orange, which is unusual in WISE, which means it's like even red and red.
Yeah, and look at this. This is what it looks like in the optical.
Yeah.
The star is in the middle, and all the red thing is a cloud of dust.
Dust shells.
It's resolved?
Yeah. So here is... You can see that the dust cloud fills our beam, basically. Right? Here's our beam. And the dust cloud is about the same size. So that's why this object is so bright. It's basically almost resolved by ACT. So this is called a carbon star, this type of star. And yeah. So that's also pretty fun.
Do you have any firsts, like any first detection of something at the gigahertz band?
Yeah. I think we had the first detection of, I think we had the first blind detection of a flaring star, for example. People had previously targeted the star and then seen some tiny little flare. Like people, ALMA had looked at Proxima Centauri and they saw a little flare, like a million times weaker than the one we saw. But because we cover the whole, like a huge area regularly, we can see rarer, brighter events.
Supernovas, for instance, I guess people saw, like, I don't know, with something else.
Yeah, we sadly haven't been able to see any supernovas, though we have looked for them.
You have not been able to see them?
We haven't, no. We had the first detection of CMB lensing, but that's a bit further back.
The local expert, have you seen any TDEs? There's these dust echoes. Do you know these things?
What?
There are these TDEs that are surrounded by dust and they have been detected in the infrared and they call them dust echoes. And it's a big thing.
Okay.
So you should, and they are super, super bright. So maybe you should see them.
Okay, I didn't know about that. But I know we have a paper where we look for various transients and tidal disruption events is one of the things we look for and we didn't find anything. But.
And they happen a bit later than the optical emission or something. So they have transient and then there's an echo that is in the infrared. So you should see the same delay.
Okay. Okay, cool. We'll look for it. All the firsts. I think we had the first detection of cluster lensing. That's a good question. I should make a list of ACT firsts so I can answer that question. I know there's a bunch of firsts, but I can't remember anymore. Sorry. Any other questions?
first KSC probably.
Yeah, first KSC and first with a pairwise KSC estimator and first with another KSC estimator. Yeah, it's basically first on everything that has to do with the small scale things at these frequencies, I think.
Are the multi-violet clouds in your maps?
Sadly not, no. If you look at our map, when it shows up, then the magic landing cloud is like here, I think. But it will be in Simons Observatory. Basically, we avoided this region of the sky because there's a large fraction of galaxy there. But for SO, we are changing our minds and we're just doing uniformly the whole area. And I think that's much better because there's lots of science that's not just CMB science. And also having these edges everywhere and uneven coverage is not nice. So in SO, we are trying hard to get even coverage. So like ACT has this sort of opportunistic scanning strategy where it's trying to scan wherever we need a bit more data, you know. And that leads to this, sometimes you hit the same spot in the sky, you know, one day and the next day. Another time it's a 2-week gap before you hit it again. That's not good for doing time domain astronomy. So so for SO, we'll just be covering the whole thing, or covering the whole thing, covering the whole thing. I don't think I have anything else unless there's any more questions. Okay.
Just a reminder, we'll have a dinner for Sigurd at 6. Thanks, everyone.
Oh, so that's a star, actually. There should be something over here. There we go. Yeah, that's 4xA. Yeah. So you can see the galaxy.
Oh, cool.
The galaxy itself is almost not visible to us, but you can see
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a crab nebula?
What?
What is that?
4xA.
4x.
4nax. Yeah. So that's huge jets with radio lobes. Actually, we see lots of radio lobes. These are the biggest ones, but in many cases, we see something on the sky that looks like.
Yeah.
Right? So that's basically an AGN and then two radio lobes. Also, this one's a bit fun. Not sure if you can see any structure here.
Yeah.
If you squint, you can sort of see two spiral arms.
Yeah.
Again, DS has censored this object. How about the bullet cluster?
Pretty impressive that you simply like scroll and find it.
Ah, come on. Sometimes it's a bit slow. Yeah, here's the bullet cluster. This is the brightest cluster in our area. And in WISE, it doesn't look that impressive. It's far away. And it's not present in DS. So, yeah.
Super cool. Thank you.